I'm Steve Lascalzo, and
this is The Way.
Welcome, and thanks for listening to This is the Way podcast's reaction and discussion episode of Chapter 23 of The Mandalorian. Season 3, Episode 7, The Spies. There's been a lot of discussion in Star Wars social media circles about who fulfills that plural reference, and I have thoughts. But rather than spend time here, I'm going to try and make the case during the podcast in response to some really good observations. That's right, I'm not certain that my take is the right one. There are some very convincing arguments out there for one particular person, but I'm really hoping that Favreau and Filoni don't resort to retconning or reframing everything we've been watching for almost three seasons now. I think there might be a misdirect, and I don't want to spend the time explaining how it should be when how it will be is only a few days away.
This is The Way.
Season 3, Episode 7 aired April 12th, 2023 for the first time. Chapter 23, The Spies, and the thumbnail description and full episode description read, "Survivors come out of hiding." Does that refer to the Mandalorians we've been following for three seasons? Maybe referring to the Remnant clan that's piloting that skimmer on the surface of Mandalore? Maybe it refers to the Imperials on Mandalore, like Moff Gideon. But when the title is The Spies and the description says survivors come out of hiding, I think that's a clue.
Very well.
Let's move on. The runtime for Episode 7, Chapter 23, shows up as 53 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page. That would make it the second longest episode so far. If you press play, you get to the credits in a little more than 47 minutes. Skip the previously on and opening sequences, and you can get through the episode in 45 and one quarter minutes. Was there anything for us to learn from the almost 2 minutes of concept art during the credits? I really enjoyed some of these interpretations. The look of Coruscant, the helmet of Gideon was a little less Maul-inspired, not having a crown of horns in the art. The Mandalorian arrival and the fleet on Navarro series was good. And then there's a nearly photographic shot of Grogu in the IG-12 mech. That was amazing. So along with the rock crab shot from a couple episodes back where he looks like Godzilla, those two might be my favorites of the season's concept art. I really liked the feast scene. There was great color and vibrancy in that art, and that led to more muted grays and greens when we get to the land skimmer shot on Mandalore and then the giant land beast that attacked. The contrast, then, with the next shot where there's magenta blasts from the Beskar troopers' blasters, that was really stark. I really liked the order that we got these shown to us, too, and I know that was the order of the episode, but it really... there was a lot of different artistic choices, even just in the concept art. The pics of the underground base on Mandalore, those were terrific. If money wasn't an object, I would really love that aesthetic in my house. I mean, the hallway with the alternating chiseled and exposed rock columns, really cool. The last shot was a little confusing because it made it look like Moff Gideon and Din Djarin are having a friendly conversation rather than he was led off after being tied and, you know, put to his knees. There they were standing, and other than the blasters of the troopers pointing at him, looked kind of peaceful. I also want to point out that the end credits are the more classical music version of the theme that we first heard at the end of the Season 2 episode, Chapter 16, The Rescue. I went back and listened to a bunch of episode credits, and I couldn't find it anywhere else. When it aired, that became some of my favorite podcast end music almost immediately. Even though, from time to time, the YouTube and the Spotify, I mean, it demonetizes my podcast from time to time, but I think it's just cool, and I don't really care that much.
Okay, then.
The credits start with the director. This week, it's Rick Famuyiwa. He is solid. I still wonder how much control he has since he's an executive producer, but he's got to work with the original creator and showrunner Favreau's scripts. And then also under he's under the further supervision of one of Lucasfilm's creative directors in Filoni. So can he make changes? I mean, I think he can suggest them, certainly. But who gets the end call? And how often is he consulting? I think almost any time he makes a change to the script, he's got to, you know, submit that to Favreau. Whereas if you're a big name director and someone's written your script, you probably don't have too much to, you know, to consult with. Your higher ups are probably the only ones that you have to deal with. But his higher ups are running the show. Well, who wrote this one? Well, writing credit for the episode belongs to Favreau and Dave Filoni. And when they partner up, I usually expect it to be for lore reasons. Director of photography on this one is David Klein. He's been here before. Rachel Goodlett-Katz was the lead editor on this one. Shauna Tripsik, once again, handles costuming. And if she's responsible for the armoring, holy cow. Can she make me a set? Because those are absolutely amazing. All right, let's move on to the people who are acting.
Nobody here gives their real name.
Pedro Pascal is the voice of the Mandalorian, but maybe not much longer if rumors are true. He's rarely in the suit anymore. It's almost always either Lateef Crowder or Brendan Wayne, and they are now credited as co-stars. Bo-Katan Kryze is played by Katie Sackhoff. Katie M. O'Brien reprises her role as Elia Kane briefly, but she's very good. Giancarlo Esposito is back as Moff Gideon, and his portrayal veers into the comically bad at times to me. I mean, I like him. I respect his acting decisions, but it's almost over the top for me, and this is Star Wars we're talking about. Carl Weathers used to be a little too cheesy for me, but I have come to accept his portrayal of Greef Karga, and maybe that's just because I've seen more of Karga recently than I have of Gideon. Emily Swallow is the armorer. I would imagine she would want to play a bad guy. I mean, that's something I always hear actors say, like, I really wanted to, you know, get my teeth into this role, but I hope she's not playing a bad guy. And we'll explain as the podcast goes on what I mean. Some are saying the armorer is a character called Rook Cast from the Clone Wars. I don't know if that checks out, but it could. Tate Fletcher is credited with the main cast this time, and I think that's an appreciation credit, because he's been inhabiting the heavy Mando suit for so long. I mean, he's Paz Vizsla, but in body only, not in voice. Because, of course, Jon Favreau is the one that's voicing Paz Vizsla. But Tate Fletcher has been that heavy Mando in the suit for quite some time. He gets credited with the main cast. Simon Cassianides, he is Axe Woves. He may have a bigger role than we initially thought. Way back in season 2 in episode 11, I think it was, or chapter 11, it didn't seem like he was a big deal, but now he's taken on a much larger role. And Casca Reeves is played by Mercedes Vernado, aka the WWE's Sasha Banks.
Sasha Banks is here!
Those were stars and co-stars. Now we're into the guest starring roles in order of appearance. Xander Berkeley was Gilad Pellion, and I cannot believe that the guy that played Gregory in Walking Dead was the same guy in this show, the mustachioed Thrawn defender. He was a highly meaningful character to readers of the Thrawn novels. And Berkeley is something of a that guy in Hollywood. He's been... Oh, so let's read off some of these. Longmire, episodes of The West Wing, The X-Files, Moonlighting, V, The Twilight Zone, CSI, Law and Order, the original Miami Vice series, The A-Team, Falcon Crest, Cagney and Lacey, we're going way back, Remington Steele, Heart to Heart, The Incredible Hulk series, the original one, MASH, back in 1981, and more recently, he was in a lot of episodes of 24. Well, what about movies? He's been in Apollo 13, Terminator 2, The Rock, Gattaca, Jumanji, Air Force One with Harrison Ford, And he's got a few good men on the resume, too.
Meantime, go and see Lieutenant Commander Joanne Galloway with Internal Affairs.
Brian Gleason was Brendel Hux. He is the son of Brendan Gleason and brother to Donald, who played Hux in the sequel trilogy. So he is playing the abusive father to his brother's character, who we will meet in the future of this timeline. The rest of the warlords, Johnny Coyne, he started as a BBC actor, worked his way into American TV and movies. As far as I can tell, this is his first Star Wars entry. Jodie Long was in Shang-Chi for Marvel, which might have been her biggest role. Henke Madera was Mr. Delmar in Spider-Man Homecoming for Marvel. Ron Batita is listed, he's listed a lot as an ADR voice artist. That's like the credit he's gotten on his IMDb page. And he's been in tons of MCU projects, but now he finally gets a turn in front of the camera here in a Star Wars debut. So good for him. Marco Khan has a distinctive face. He was in The Chosen, 2 God's Not Dead movies, and I have to imagine it was the role in Iron Man as a guard that probably got him in the room, you know, since that was Favreau directing that one. And then Imelda Corcoran is our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. entry for today's podcast, having played Dr. Goodman for a couple episodes way back in 2014. She was also recently in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier series, and she was in Lost. Parvesh Chhina voiced Greef Karga's copper-plated protocol droid. Wesley Kimmel played Ragnar again, although I don't think he had a line. Shirley Henderson did, because she voices the Anzellans, and there was only one of them, and it might have been reused dialogue, since it exclaims,
"Bad baby! No,
it's crazy!" Taika Waititi's recordings may have been reused as well, because he only has 2 words as the newly designated mech suit, IG-12.
No. Yes.
The survivor scout is Charles Baker. He's the one that steers the skiff, and he was Skinny Pete from Breaking Bad. So he was in that show, El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie, Mayor of Kingstown, CSI Vegas, and the new Perry Mason. The captain was Charles Parnell, but he played an admiral in Top Gun Maverick, didn't he?
I think you misunderstand, Captain.
He has voiced for Grand Theft Auto 4, Mass Effect, Call of Duty, and a Marvel Avengers video game. He was a voice on Venture Brothers. He showed up in 2 NCIS shows, The Mentalist, Law and Order, CSI Miami, Lie to Me, Longmire, Fringe, Bones, Barry, and was on The Last Ship. And he was Derek Fry on All My Children for 80 episodes. There are many more performances in this episode that probably someone really wants to know about. But there are so many performance artists and doubles and stunt performers. There are hundreds of people making music, creating the code and the computer graphic images. I'm just trying to focus on the most notable, because otherwise I wouldn't have time to talk about the episode at all, which I'm going to do next. Last episode, the Disney snap was not part of the opening, but this time it wasn't on Wednesday through maybe Saturday, and then it returned on Sunday night. They did not place a snap before Guns for Hire, though, which still doesn't have it. I mean, it wasn't there Friday when I started working hard on this version of the notes for my show. When I went back to collect more audio on Sunday for The Spies, well, there was a snap there. Anyway, the previously on segment starts with Grogu looking out on Mandalore from episode 2 when the new Republic spy R5-D4 gives Din Djarin an atmospheric reading. Din Djarin mentions that Bo-Katan is right, planet's not cursed. Well, that's certainly an opinion, isn't it? From there, we go to the armor declaring to the group at the end of the pirate that the goal is to retake Mandalore.
The mercenary captain, Axe Wolves, indicated that he split from you because you had designs on ruling Mandalore once again.
Then we're shown some brief dialogue between Axe and Bo-Katan on Plazir 15. Then there was the duel and submission. Then we hear Axe declare about the Darksaber and then Din Djarin's explanation how Bo-Katan is the rightful owner. of the Darksaber. Then we see the derelict Lambda shuttle that had been carrying the prisoner Moff Gideon and hear from Carson Teva. Then we see Dr. Pershing get mind-flayed by Ellie Kane, and the Lucasfilm Limited and Star Wars slates appear before we head into the new episode. The episode opens on Coruscant. It's raining, which seems impossible to me if the entire planet's covered with metal and concrete. But okay. Ellie Kane is looking over her shoulder nervously, if you ask me. It's because she's a spy from Moff Gideon. I mean, she's not meeting him here, or a contact. She's headed to a rendezvous with an Imperial probe droid. So think about it. Gideon, we discover later, is on Mandalore. Communication isn't possible between the surface and orbit using normal means. We heard that. This droid, however, was tech the Empire used, developed for deep space spying.
What was it?
A droid of some kind. I didn't hit it that hard. Must have had a self-destruct.
An Imperial probe droid.
It would make sense. This would be a way to communicate off-world. Seeing a probe droid would raise red flags, though, so this is a clandestine meeting. It's in a dark alley, very Star Wars. Her Imperial designation, we discover, is TK2755. You type that into Google by itself, and you end up getting Turkish Airlines flight number 2755. You have to type Star Wars before or after it to bring her up. It doesn't appear to be a reference anywhere. Moff Gideon appears, and his thematic score is heard under Kane's report that the pirates failed in their efforts on Navarro. It's not as upsetting to Gideon as the information that it was a joint effort by two previously opposing factions of Mandalorians and not the New Republic that caused his efforts to fail.
Continue with your mission. I shall deal with our Mandalorian friends.
I don't know why he's just hearing this information from Kane if he's got an inside spy. So I think this is an indication that this is the first time he's hearing this information. There's no spy inside the Mandalorian covert. I mean, that's just one clue.
I don't know where you get your delusions, laser brain.
There's an interesting walk Gideon takes from where he takes the hologram meeting to the next hologram meeting. It's a walkway guarded by laser shields, and they are precariously perched stormtroopers with white and gray color scheme. I mean, we hear later these are Beskar armored stormtroopers. But why is this location so heavily guarded? I mean, it's only for one reason. It just looks cool. Gideon gets through the weird security check, and there's a room of clones in tanks. Very similar to what we had seen on Navarro in Season 2, The Siege. Where is this place he's at now? Well, we know from later in the episode, of course, but let's suppose at one point Gideon had that working base on Navarro, but the Mandalorians were operating there as a covert. If he wanted them wiped out, why didn't he do it then? What's the purpose of allowing them to operate on this Imperial-controlled world? We know that this base is not Navarro, but why would he do anything there? Why not move completely into this Mandalorian underground? And if you're going to make Navarro an outpost, why not retaliate at any time in between the defeat and the hiring of the pirates? Why not have the First Order, the nascent First Order, this, you know, why not have the Warlord show up and say, oh, we'll free you from the pirates? Why wait at all? If you're going to try it yourself first, why not come back and finish the job? I think we get a little of that information very early in the next scene.
The New Republic is vulnerable, but we must be cautious and show no sign of our true strength.
Easy for you to say, Captain. There's a fortune to be had, plundering the hyperspace lanes.
Commander, your hit and run operations are gaining too much notice. If we are perceived as anything other than a group of unorganized remnant warlords, the New Republic will increase their efforts to hunt us down.
The people in these holograms are spies, and they employ spies. And this entire scene is chock full of important items. I mean, I don't want to play the whole scene for you, but you got name drops of Grand Admiral Thrawn, Gilad Pellion, Brendel Hux, and through Project Necromancer's name drop, we hear how Palpatine somehow returns. Thrawn was only thwarted after efforts of the Ghost crew and Ezra Bridger. Otherwise, he would absolutely have helped crush the rebellion, Luke Skywalker or not. Pellion is apparently his right-hand man, and that comes from other media like books and comics. Brendel Hux is the abusive father to the Hux that we know from the sequel trilogy, someone who states,
"I'm the spy."
So, again, plenty of references to multiple spies already. By the way, a necromancer is a raiser of the dead, specifically in this case, Emperor Palpatine, and we do hear in the dialogue from this meeting of the Shadow Council, Hux is in charge of that program, not Gideon. So, he did not want Pershing and Grogu to awaken the dark side of the Force or bring back the Emperor. Gideon wants his own army of Force-sensitive troops, perhaps created in his image. After all, he does later decry that the Dark Trooper's only flaw seemed to be that he wasn't in the armor. Who else wears a robotic suit in this episode, I wonder? Thrawn isn't just absent from our story so far, he's absent, it seems, from the Council, too. He's represented at all times by Pellion. The promise of this return of such a powerful Imperial officer was enough to stay the hands of the other warlords, at least temporarily. They're getting antsy. You know, the only thing Imperial officers respect is someone more powerful than themselves. Here, Gideon is introducing Discord to seize some of it for himself.
And what is your security concern?
Mandalorians.
What? They continue to be an issue?
They do. I am increasingly confident that they are preparing to retake their home world of Mandalore.
A certain Mandalore would hamper our efforts.
Which is why we need to stamp them out now.
That's the explanation he gives for his requests of 3 Praetorian Guards, the Red Cloak Guardians I wondered about since Return of the Jedi, and then they were later revealed to simply be tough guys with cool weapons rather than mind-controlled, Force-sensitive clones or droids. I mean, seriously, the sequel trilogy ruined Guys in All Red for me. You know, I just remember those guards for Palpatine. Anyway, he doesn't just want the guards. He wants more TIE interceptors like the one he lost on Navarro when he was, you know, flying it, and then Din Djarin came and, you know, put bombs on it. And then he also wants bombers like the one destroyed by Bo-Katan on Kalevala, or above Kalevala. Remember, she blew one up? Let's remember, Bo-Katan's home was bombed shortly after they left Mandalore. She rescued Din from the Living Waters, and almost immediately, there was a response. There were fighters on her tail, so they may have tracked the N1 back to Kalevala. So someone came to our planet, and then they left. You know, let's track it. I just don't think it's reasonable to have tracked the gauntlet this time, because it happens too fast to have scrambled the fighters and bombers, then devise a plan simply from the gauntlet taking off. They would have needed to know where to go first. And then when they see both are safe and returning once again to Kalevala, then we put our plan into action. We're going to go try to shoot her down, draw her away from her home, and then we'll buy it. Someone on the surface was spying on them. The surface of Mandalore. For Gideon to not know 100% that the Mandalorians are planning to retake their homeworld, but know anything, suggests to me that he heard from someone that he trusts, but not someone on the inside. I think this suggests that there is a spy, maybe someone who is operating on a rich world, dealing with a lot of goods being loaded and unloaded in trade. Someone who hired Mandalorians ostensibly for protection, but maybe it was to keep tabs on them. And maybe this person just spoke directly with someone involved in the Mandalorian movement, but has ties to the Empire from the past?
Exactly.
Let's address the banter in the room. I was once a facilities planning officer during the war, and thanks to the New Republic Amnesty Program, I was able to help rebuild Plazia 15.
You were Imperial?
He was.
Yeah, Captain Bombardier. That would make yet another spy. Din Djarin, who checked out the surface of Mandalore for everyone else, Elia Kane from Moff Gideon, R5-D4 for Carson Teva, Moff Gideon for the Shadow Council, the entire Shadow Council, on each other and others, and Captain Bombardier. I'm sure there are more that I missed or forgot about. And there are probably more in this episode to come, but there are already a lot of spies.
We shall be rid of the Mandalorians once and for all. Long live the Empire!
Long live the Empire!
The citizens of Navarro just got done with an invasion of hired hands, and they're rebuilding. Now another repurposed pirate ship is hovering overhead. These mercenaries are the good guys, though, right? The protocol droid makes a mistake with ship classification. I mean, come on. This is a droid. That's not supposed to happen. Grief Karga corrects the protocol droid, which isn't the first time he's done so this season. So who's programming these things? Then we get an awesome shot of the armorer coming out of the darkness of her tent and into the light. Din and Bo-Katan are returning with a very large group to meet the surviving children of the Watch.
I hope these two groups get along. They've never met. And what little they know of each other, they hate.
They will if they want to survive.
We know this. Din clearly does because he said it. Bo-Katan knows this. The armorer knows it. Everybody knows they should get along. But that's easier said than done. There's lots of bad blood, as we heard Lady Kree say last episode. She had her knife to Axe's throat when she said it. Side note, the fleet landing on the lava flats was really cool. I mean, this animation, maybe not as cool as a space battle, but pretty cool. I mean, it really was. Seeing the ships land like that just seemed like something I haven't seen a lot of, and I liked it.
Take the children inside.
Something I noticed. The children of the Watch have children of the Watch. I mean, maybe the other faction's children stayed on the fleet, but I'm not sure there are any there. Maybe too much fighting and pirating to procreate? It was a small detail, but it stood out to me. There's lots of tension in the group. Suddenly, the armorer bangs her tools together and says, "Let's party."
Welcome, fellow Mandalorians. We invite you to make camp. Let us prepare a feast for our guests.
There was a slightly discordant tone to the Mandalorian theme there, but I don't think that's in reference to the armorer as much as it was the tone of the camp at this point.
Mando! Welcome back, my friend. Welcome back.
And one more time for the confused, Grief Karga heard Din's name from Moff Gideon in Season 1. And that's if he already hadn't known it, because if Gideon knew to say it, I'm sure the Guildmaster of the Navarro chapter of the Bounty Hunters could have found that out. But he calls him Mando in a camp full of Mandalorians. Not one of them flinches or turns their heads. This is not to say he is the only Mandalorian. Obviously not. This is not saying he's the only one referred to like that ever in the galaxy or in the universe. It's to prove one last time for us, he is the Mandalorian that the show title references. I mean, at least for now. Karga has this beverage gift in a really cool container all the way from Coruscant. I'm sure people want to have it now. It's a nice welcome gift.
Thank you.
That's not the only gift I have for you.
Okay, I'm going to try to talk briefly about this next scene. It's the one I've been dreading for maybe more than a year. I can't remember when I read about it. A spoiler listed a mech suit for Grogu. Specifically, it said in that spoiler it was like Iron Man. Now, since Jon Favreau kickstarted the modern MCU for us with Iron Man, bringing a character I had personally never cared for in the very least to the big screen, doing it successfully, I might add, to the point where everybody was excited to see what came next. I mean, one might think, Let Favreau put in a nod to the MCU here or there.
No.
What do you mean, no?
No.
Yeah, no. Grogu is the only reason I think this scene works at all and this concept works. I mean, we give ourselves over to this, even though, on paper, this seems like a profoundly stupid idea. I had said I was prejudiced against this scene last week after I heard it was coming. That's because Star Wars Celebration in London got to see a sneak peek. I was ready to rip this scene and, as a result, the entire episode to shreds. I could not help myself. I am powerless to resist Grogu's charm. Disney cannot lose Grogu. I mean, there is about as much plot armor and intellectual property armor as a character can get. You cannot get rid of him. It would be the most profoundly stupid idea Lucasfilm or Disney could possibly have to get rid of this character.
Would you look at that?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes. 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 Yes.
There is a brief scene where we get some Din being daddy to Grogu. He's exploring with a suit. There's a Melu run melon squeezy.
Oh, a squeezy!
Din has to shell out credits for all the stuff he's grabbing. And it's a scene that means more to a parent, I think, than others right now. I mean, that's the way I look at it. And then we get to the I Will Go scene. Bo-Katan makes her case for the retaking of Mandalore at the feast.
Mandalorians, it is time to retake our homeworld. Even though the planet is not cursed, there are still dangers. Dormant species have been awakened from the bombings. The remaining magnetic interference has made it impossible to scan the surface from above atmosphere. Which is why I'm proposing that we leave Navarro and move the fleet into orbit above Mandalore. We send down a small recon party. We'll scout the surface, find out what remains of the Great Forge, and establish a safe perimeter. Only then will we bring down the others. I need volunteers from both tribes.
There's a little pause between when she finishes and then the next person speaks. According to the closed captioning, by the way, it's the Mandalorian who speaks. His response wouldn't be notable, except it's much different from "This is the way," and everyone adopts the same phrase.
I will go. Grogu as well.
In the first episode of this season, we saw a piece of glass which had a portion of Exodus inscribed in Mandoa on it. And now we get Ruth 1:16, but Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God." The biblical theme fits. Like it or not. You know, the prop department literally created a section of Exodus translated into Mandoa onto that fragment of Mandalorian glass. That wasn't something they picked up at a garage sale and thought looked cool. We are free to speculate. But clearly there's some biblical imagery going on. One thing I could not help but notice is Din volunteers Grogu. He should really have stayed with the Foundlings. But maybe it's just that the only dangers Din thinks he's going to face are natural ones. You know, the Alamites, and at worst, maybe another spider tank, and then you're going to have the rest of the team around to help handle that. But also, the armorer is going on an away mission. She is wearing a red plate of armor. I know. This is Star Wars, not Star Trek.
I will go as well.
She does get a nod of either approval or thanks from Bo-Katan. Then we see the fleet take off, and almost as cool as the landing was before, the shot of them coming out of light speed above Mandalore with Concordia looming in the background. That was something really cool, something I really enjoyed. Then the gauntlet starts its descent into the atmosphere with a reminder from Bo-Katan that they're going to lose comms. I wondered if the drop seats were the only place for the Mandalorians in the group to sit, and I guess so. A whole team drops out, scouts for the landing, but that's not something she did prior. And also, why not go much closer to where you think the forge would be based on where she knows the Living Waters entrance was? Again, why not? If you think the only threats are subterranean Alamites and maybe some of those spider tanks, why not descend directly into the city center? Then you would know where to go. It might have helped to do a little more surface scouting, though, with the shields up. But then we wouldn't get the story we got, right?
It's worse than I thought. I was here when it happened.
Before the drop, there was that quick convo between Paz, Vizsla, and Axe Woves. And if you were to tell me that there was going to be a traitor in the third season among the Mandalorians, I don't know how you wouldn't pick a descendant of pre-Vizsla. But I don't think that's the intention. In this context, though, wouldn't you say the odds would favor Axe Woves?
Never tell me the odds.
Sheesh, sorry, Han. Din tells Bo-Katan the group is ready. She commands them to secure the infill zone. I guess she meant the landing zone, or the LZ. They do little more than jetpack down and look around. They declare the area secure, and Bo-Katan lands. Again, they're landing ridiculously far from where they even suspect the forge to be. If they know which direction to go, and that it's a long way, then why land here? It doesn't make much sense. But remember, it's Bo-Katan that picks the spot, not the armor. It's not like the armor says, let's go right here because I have to meet somebody.
Do you have food?
We do.
You wear the crest of the Night Owls.
I should hope so. They're Mandalorians.
Is that the voice of Lady Bo-Katan Kryze?
It is.
So after that long walk from the gauntlet, the group runs into this land-skimming windcraft coming straight at them. They stopped far out of range, which, okay, does suggest that this group was wary of the ones who are walking on the surface, but I just really doubt that they would remember Bo-Katan's voice. The armorer suggests they are Mandalorians. And that's not what I doubt. I do think them coming straight at them and identifying from that far out the Night Owl crest and Bo-Katan's voice suggests they're on a mission and knew who they were meeting here. Later, the group of them describe how their numbers have dwindled, some disappearing below. I think they did. I think they disappeared because they now serve as spies for the Imperial presence, either luring in more recruits or leading explorers into traps. The captain of this group says the Imperials took no prisoners. Well, they may have taken defectors. Earlier in the episode, we got a scene with two groups coming together for a feast. In a sense, this is the same thing over again. This time it's on the land skimmer between the scout team and then those representing themselves as surface survivors of the Purge. You can tell I don't trust them, right? With the presence of the Imperials on the planet, are we really supposed to believe that they don't know of this group skimming the surface? The Imperials don't know they're here? Are we further to believe that the survivors don't immediately mention, hey, be careful, there's an Imperial presence here? Have they never seen an Imperial ship since the Purge? It's very suspicious.
We knew you would not forsake us, Lady Bo-Katan. We have failed you. But our blasters remain in your service.
Why is this suspicious? Well, I mean, we knew you wouldn't forsake us. In the next scene, the captain tees up Bo-Katan. He says, the Empire punished Mandalore for refusing to surrender. Bo-Katan admits she did surrender after the Night of a Thousand Tears when the ISB offered to negotiate a ceasefire. She had one chance to save survivors and she took it. Moff Gideon got what he wanted, the Darksaber and submission, and he did not honor the deal. No one seemed surprised by that. I cannot believe, though, anyone with honor at the table would see Gideon as the rightful ruler. The survivors both wonder, how did the Children of the Watch survive, And we get the answer. They were sheltered on Concordia, says the armorer. They are not Death Watch, though they may have once been. But it's split into warring factions, and I think we're seeing a few of those come together.
Mandalore has always been too powerful for any enemy to defeat. It is always our own division that destroys us.
A house divided against itself cannot stand. That's what that sounds like. The next scene is about as romantic as we're going to get in Star Wars, I guess. Din says to Bo he understands her now. Bo says, "You were right," to Din. He says, "We'll rebuild it," speaking of Mandalore. He says that's how it's been for thousands of years. She admits she doesn't know if she can lead. And is this blade enough to overcome the animosity and unify our people? Din tells her plainly, "I only know about the blade from what you say, but it doesn't mean anything to me or my people. Nor does station, nor bloodline."
"What means more to me is honor, and loyalty, and character. These are the reasons I serve you, Lady Kreese. Your song is not yet written. I will serve you until it is."
If I'm reading between the lines, I love you just the way you are. I mean, a man here is saying, "I misunderstood. Now I really understand you," to a woman. "Honor and loyalty and character, those are the reasons I serve you," to a woman. "And your song is not yet written. I will serve you until it is." That sounds like it comes right out of a romance novel. And then Bo-Katan, a woman, says three words earlier in the conversation that are music to a man's ears.
"You were right."
We may not get an "I love you" or even an "I know," but that's about all the Star Wars romance you're going to see in this show, I think. I can't believe that they're waiting for something and then that they would take it away from. Like, you don't just build up to this romance and then present it and then end it in one episode. Maybe there's a future, and maybe there's a season 4 future for Bo-Katan and Din Djarin, but I don't know if everybody's going to make it out alive. Anyway, the next scene is Bo-Katan consulting the armor for what to do about ailing survivors. She wants to take him back to the fleet, the armor does. That's completely innocuous. Except we know what happens later. So any survivors that can come along are welcome, says Bo-Katan. They're going to head to the Great Forge. The captain says, "I can do better than tag along. I can lead you straight to the Great Forge." Now, why not also just take the ship, leave that land skimmer where it stands, and take the ship directly to where the Great Forge is? Anyway, if I am Favreau and I need to get the armor back to the fleet, this is a super efficient way to do it. But why? I mean, if you're going to have her be the traitor, you're going to do it in person or face to face. You want that dialogue and that reveal and that "I am the spy" kind of a thing. These new friends, they are much more likely a set of spies than the armor.
"Onward, Mandalorians! To the Forge!"
The next day, the armor takes off with survivors for the fleet to seek medical care. And again, why not pilot them directly to the Forge? But the shots linger on the two groups. One's leaving for the Forge, and one is leaving for orbit. I think it's because they're in two different ships heading in different directions. That's why Femi Iwa was contrasting these two scenes. But I can definitely see why someone might think it's an indicator, and it does seem like it, that maybe we're supposed to pay attention to something here. When we head back to the skiff, Paz Vizsla is playing a chess-like game with Axe Woves. But it's not holographic. It's not even like the Jarg game R2 and Chewbacca play on the Falcon in A New Hope. It's just a new game. And I'm kind of thankful for that. It wouldn't make sense to have a holographic machine on that ship. There's a dispute about the rules of the game, and imagine that. Two factions at war on the board have followed different rules. It's a little on the nose, but I think we can allow it. I mean, there's a fight, and I'm always wondering about this honored fighting. Like, what? You're not tickle fighting. I mean, you got vibroblades out. Are they really going to kill each other? Like, is that how you solve all your disputes? Is this duel? And what happens if somebody gets severely injured? Fortunately, we don't have to wonder about that here, because Grogu steps in the middle, not figuratively, actually steps in between using the IG-12 suit.
No.
That is, you know, pardon the pun, I guess, a huge step for this little guy to go from watching what happens all the time to actually getting involved, stepping in between. Maybe because now he's actually able to do that, or maybe because he felt this was more meaningful. I mean, he could have just used the Force, right, to hold him back. But he manages to get Axe and Paz to settle down.
You taught your apprentice well.
You didn't learn that from me.
They still haven't united against a common enemy, but we're going to see that soon. We get a scene with the armor leaving atmosphere for orbit. She immediately contacts the fleet. Not the actions of a traitor, in my opinion. Whoever this was left in charge contacts back, says they'll receive the alien survivors, but this guy doesn't have much experience. He didn't ask a number or ask what happened. Hey, do you need backup? What happened there? There's injured Mandalorians? Do we need to send somebody down there? Here the armor is returning. No one seems concerned with why people are wounded or ailing or need medical assistance. That ship then has relatively smooth sailing compared to what the skiff is going to experience. A monster awakens from this glassy surface and it's angry. The scout in the crow's nest recognizes the danger first and doesn't seem to be like putting on airs. I mean, there's some falling glass and stuff, but rather than steer away, a survivor clearly steers them into the path of the monster. Then the ship is destroyed, they take cover underground, and there is a Star Wars wipe there. So there's an unknown amount of time passed, and then suddenly they're at the Great Forge. That's a lot to skip right there. You could have had an entire scene, the next scene, where they're describing, oh, we're on our way to the Great Forge and all that stuff. Because the Night Owl faction gives us a little history lesson and then remarks how important it was. But you could have had that and then had them walk through a cave and then come out on the other side. And then, oh, the fires are out since the Purge. But the survivor captain pipes up, and this is all one scene. He wants everyone to know, hey, we've been surviving on the surface, and people that explored underground were never heard from again. Remember I said that. This is just before.
Jetpacks.
More survivors.
Those aren't Mandalorians.
Take cover.
A fight breaks out, and a survivor gets shot right in the Beskar. I went back and looked. So he or she gets knocked down. But it's Beskar. That survivor's going to be okay. How do I know? Moments later, two shots from our hero group hit off a stormtrooper. And by the way, they are rendered in really bad computer graphics if you go back. You look at it, but they keep attacking. Turns out they're Beskar troopers wearing white, black, and brushed metal gray costumes. You know, I mean, they're costumes, but this is their armor. I mean, I can already see the Black Series action figure in my mind. Our hero group is pinned down on this outcropping. Two of the survivors are knocked off the ledge. Oh no! They're wearing jetpacks. They're not going to be seriously hurt unless they forget how to pilot their jetpacks. Our heroes are pinned down, however. Axe suggests, hey, let me try and get to the fleet to send reinforcements. A couple episodes ago, they ran out of fuel just flying along the surface. Now, he's going to have enough to get to orbit? This is before we hear the fleet is in danger. Paz lays down cover fire. Axe escapes through a crack in the glass ceiling. And now that I say it like that, it should have been Koskaris, right? But maybe it's because Axe is not telling the truth. The stormtroopers suddenly start to run off, except it's through hallways that look very suspiciously Imperial. The Mandalorians are in pursuit, including Grogu, who's told to keep up in this IG suit. Somehow, the Mandalorian, our Mandalorian, goes from the back of the pack, reminding Grogu, keep up, to the front and in the vanguard. And he's one of the ones to come into the hangar first. It's in fact an Imperial base. TIE interceptors and bombers are hanging from the ceiling of this immense hangar, just under the surface, but near the Great Forge. Now, if you're Moff Gideon, what a really suspect place to put your base. I mean, unless you're doing it near the Forge, because you were in fact using it, but we see the fires are not lit. Why not make a TIE interceptor, too, out of Beskar? If you're that much of a zealot, like Gideon seems to be, why not commission your own Beskar TIE interceptor? Anyway, our heroes chase the troopers into a trap. Din Djarin is the only one captured alive by the Beskar troopers. And they were using their grapples to tie him up and then force him to his knees.
Disarm him.
Gideon had arrived via jetpack. He traps a large part of the group behind a set of blast doors. He's going to send our Mandalorian off in a moment to do a debriefing. But first, he's basically got to tell everyone his plans like a good Bond villain.
Thank you for gathering the Mandalorians into one place. You were a talented people, but your time has passed. However, as you can see, Mandalore will live on in me. Thanks to your planet's rich resources, I have created the next generation Dark Trooper suit, forged from Beskar alloy. And the most impressive improvement is that it has me in it. You see, every society has something to offer. The cloners, the Jedi, and even the Mandalorians. By aggregating the best of each, I will create an army that will bring order to the galaxy. Why don't we take your fleet off the board while we still have the element of surprise? Activate the interceptors and bombers.
No!
In but a few moments, the purge of Mandalore will be complete. Take him to the debriefing room.
There are some really bad line readings from Giancarlo Esposito in this episode. I think he's just being mustache twirly with this portrayal, but it's kind of bad.
Bo-Katan. We have to stop meeting like this.
I'll make sure of it.
Let's skip the pleasantry, shall we? I believe this is the part where you return the Darksaber to its rightful owner.
The fleet is in trouble. Ties are scrambled, and he demands the Darksaber from Bo-Katan and submission, but this time there's no offer of a deal. Instead of surrender, they're all going to fight it out. But I would have liked Bo-Katan feigning, hey, alright, I will surrender once again, and then use the Darksaber against him. That's not how Favreau writes this out, though. He has a retreat, use the Darksaber to cut through a blast door, freeze the group trapped between the blast doors, but Gideon wants to wipe them out. So he opens the door nearest to him, but then he jets off.
They could get away.
No, no, no. I'm going to leave them alone and not actually witness them dying. I'm just going to assume it all went to plan. What? You just don't get it, do you? You don't.
I don't mind that being a strategy screw up, but it's, I mean, that's very Imperial, if you ask me, to screw up like that. But the tank of the group is really the star of this scene, because he specced himself right for this fight. He's got the best DKP raid gear, he's using the best temporary buffs, and the captain of the group's giving him inspiration, and he's putting in some heavy DPS with that railgun. I mean, I'm talking about Paz Vizsla, once referred to as Heavy Mando, or Heavy Infantry Mando. That was either in credits, colloquially by the crew. At the very least, he was named so in an action figure as Heavy Infantry Mandalorian. He is staying at the rear of the retreat while The group gets through that little hole, and he's fending off the troopers from Moff Gideon's side, and then he locks himself in the hangar with them. He shoots so much, we see his rail gun blaster overheat. And then he doesn't stop fighting. He throws himself at them, throws them around, knocks some of them off the side. But again, they're all wearing jetpacks. I mean, John, you cannot write them falling over if you've given them jetpacks. Have them at least disable them or something. And they were wearing them. I checked. But the tank lasts the whole fight. And then a new boss wave spawns in. I know, video gamers are... I'm using a lot of video game metaphors, or, you know, just bear with me. Three Praetorian guards decide to wait until now to jump in to help. They're all in red. They got those purple, you know, electric weapons that they do from The Last Jedi. But, you know, of course they wait until now, right? He's got no blaster. They're melee only, right? The red clad guards make short work of the tank. He was spec'd for range damage, after all, not melee. Paz Vizsla. He's dead. Those guards, I guess, are precursors to Snoke's guard and descendant from Palpatine's guard. But if these survive the show and then go on to guard Snoke, we know what will happen to them at the hands of Kylo and Rey, don't we? So what do I think about this episode? Well, one episode remains to wrap it all up. I saw an amazing point brought up on Twitter by Alfie Molinaro. He says the spies are Bo-Katan and Din. His reasoning, the Book of Numbers and Deuteronomy. Spies in the Bible referring to the ones going into the Promised Land to give report to Moses and Aaron and the remnant of Israel. Only two of them gave good reports when they came back. The rest of them said, no, we can't go there. They're going to kill us. But Joshua and Caleb were faithful. The rest said challenges would be too great. We're not going to be able to take the land. There are giants there. They're descendants of the Nephilim. Well, and they wanted to stone Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb, cursing them because they were saying things like, you know, it would have been better for us to die in captivity in Egypt or at the hands of the Egyptians on the escape rather than wait so long and then fall right at the end. So what happens in that story? Well, God shows up in the tent, chastises them all, and points out to the older generation, you're going to die in the wilderness without seeing the Promised Land. Not even Moses will see it for a separate reason. But when people hear God is angry, they think, oh, well, we'll go now that you're angry, except God already pronounced their fate. No one over 20 at the time of the pronouncement will enter the Promised Land except Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb. The Israelites go up to a ridge, get slaughtered by the Canaanites, fulfilling God's verdict. And there are other spies as well in the Bible. Joshua chapter 2 speaks of Rahab and the spies sent into Jericho. That's the town with the walls that famously crumble. So maybe this base will suffer a similar fate. And maybe the Mandalorians will suffer a similar fate. Maybe the Mythosaur is going to tear down the walls of the base. Maybe those that fell away from the way will die at the hands of the enemy, and only true believers will end up reforming Mandalore. Boy, I am having a real hard time waiting for chapter 24 to see what happens.
What do you think?
Are you excited for the finale? There's lots of possibilities. I, for one, hope Favreau and Filoni opt for continuing the themes that they've already set up and not going for a reframe of those first two seasons to fit this one. A lot could happen. I have hope they're going to do the right thing with the story, though, and continue rather than try to reinvent.
This is the way.
If you'd like to give your thoughts, please do. Interact with us in one of several ways. Find out how? Visit our Linktree site at linktr.ee/thisistheway pod. Email goes to thisistheway podcast@gmail.com. Twitter and Instagram handles are both @thisistheway pod, and on Facebook, it's just like Linktree. /thisistheway pod. Search for us now on YouTube as well, and please subscribe there and everywhere. Thank you for joining me for This Is The Way Podcast's reaction and discussion of The Spies, Season 3, Episode 7, Chapter 23 of The Mandalorian. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. May the Force be with you, always.